usually it's peace and quiet, but one does not feel very peaceful at this hour, especially when he's the kind of animal whose heart doesn't start to beat before 12 o'clock. And of course the topic, as it's announced on the board, while it has indicated and presented a certain amount of maybe that was some sort of sign. Hertzfeldt, all you've got to say could probably go on a couple of postcards, maybe, I don't know. We're going to talk a little bit about black religion. And as I said, with almost every one of the quotes, lectures that I've had to present, I don't like to lecture as much as I like to present a few short statements which best express what I'm trying to get across, and then open it up even during the lecture hour for discussions. I've been doing Jesus for at least two lectures, and we had a certain abortive tries at some other subjects that we're going to try again later on this week. We'll try and steer you away from discussing those until the forum on Thursday night, I believe, or whatever the schedule says out there. But this morning we want to try and look at some of the structure and some of the personalities behind what has created the climate for some of us to move sociologically and above all theologically. The black church or black religion. Not too much has been done on this particular subject, other than a few occasional attempts at defining, if you will, the phenomena of the black church and black religion. Usually the posture was quite denigrating. The black religious experience, as it has been viewed by most folk, has been one that is a few degrees above, if you will, the halo-ridden stereotype descriptions of folk in Africa. Pagan, heathen, emotional, etc. However, the articulation of the black experience, starting about 1954 in the person of Martin King, and also the profound ability of the black preacher to do more than communicate, but to have his spirit move from behind the rostrum, if you will, and not only capture the imagination, but the very bodies of the folk to whom the message was addressed. So that the black preacher was probably much more adept at putting flesh on Plato's bones or giving warmth to the religious experience than most folk were. Probably that experience is found only now in the history of the Christian church and the catacombs or in the arenas, the 300 years between Pentecost and Constantine. In the New Testament, the church has been defined as having three distinct functions. And we use Greek words to describe these functions: kerygma, or preaching, diakonia or service, and koinonia, the name which this hall bears, which means very simply fellowship. The Lutheran definition, and Marty always says, question number 103, under part 3 of Martin Luther's catechism, talks about church being where the gospel is preached and where the sacraments are celebrated. Well, we're not arguing that this is not the church, but we are arguing, however, that this experience has been quite delimiting, at least as it has been used by Western Christianity. The black church and black religion, I think, has in many ways fulfilled the New Testamental concept of what church is. Consequently, Lutherans and others have sort of defined the whole black religious experience as a kind of social gospel. Our difficulty at this point is that we may not be able to get at differentiating between man as a social creature and man as a religious one. The preaching tells the world about Christ's victory over alien and hostile forces. These alien and hostile forces, as we discussed in Jesus, have been quite invisible and quite removed from persons. And some of you will remember, those of you who heard these lectures, that we defined the demonic, or we defined the devil, if you will, as not being black or red or yellow or brown, but some other color. You who did not hear it might figure that one out relatively easy. Service is defined in the person and work of Jesus, achieving the ultimate in identification with the whole healing and reconciling ministry which characterized him. It does not mean let's discuss it or let's call a committee meeting to see what we're going to do about it. It does not mean retreating, if you will, to the cliche, now this is going to take time. It means dealing with the empirical, recognizing that the revolution is on, and whose side are you going to be on? Early in the history of the black experience in this country, this decision was made. Fellowship in the black church is different, if you will, from the kind of vacillations and duplicity which we since have characterized Western Christianity up to this particular point, some divorcement from the norm. Now, we talked last week a little bit about some of the innovative things that are being done now, even inside of those who are inextricably identified with Western religion. Underground churches and other things are cases in point. Quickly to review historically the black church. It was born in slavery. There are a lot of stories about how the black church got started, but we accept the one where black people, slaves, the house niggers, if you will, who were close to the master and who drove his chariots, his carriages and what have you, including driving him to church and waiting outside, sometimes going inside, picked up bits and pieces of the white man's religion and took them back to the slave camps and to the slave shacks, and there they had worship. However, this worship was worked into the black condition. And worship was a daily thing with the black people, who found in their nothingness the kind of isness which white folk always have claimed can only come from the Creator and the Redeemer. Some of us are now toying around with the demythologizing of the black spiritual. Quickly then, we now see that the black spiritual was in fact the white man's savior, or the white man's religion, if you will, became his savior, because instead of dealing with the tormentor and the oppressor as he needed to be dealt with, black religion wrestled with God vis-a-vis the black spiritual, and the highly emotional, very soulful prayers which still mark the black church and black people. Black people found it difficult to believe or accept it, a life on earth, less difficult to accept a life in heaven. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen, nobody knows but Jesus. I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes. When we get to heaven, we're going to put on our shoes and do the appropriate thing, dance all over God's heaven. I'll fly away to Jesus. Steal away to Jesus. Lord, I want to be a Christian in my heart. Rock of my soul in the bosom of Abraham. All expressions of the other world. And as the black church was defined by white preachers later on, it became a sort of pie in the sky kind of religion. But the black experience and the black worship was not all that sort of thing. In fact, it was a ruse, if you will, a sort of a put-on. It's pretty much the same kind of put-on that we find in the dialogue between the white man and the black man in Silberman's Crisis in Black and White. Shucking and jiving, if you will, telling the man what he wanted to hear, but in the meantime doing all of this in order to disarm him so that you could get at what you really wanted to get at. And out of the black experience, the black religious experience, came then the first glimpses of freedom and independence from not only Western Christianity, but also all of the things which marked systematic disenfranchisement and dispossession. And that's why the black preacher became very, very early in the history of slavery not just a revolutionary figure, but a revolutionary. Richard Allen, the founder of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, refused to accept a back seat in the church, which was a balcony. Balconies in churches and in theaters were always described as the nigger heaven. You see, that's where the niggers were, and in the balconies, and they always had to come to the altar last. Well, Richard Allen said, I won't do that anymore, and he walked out of this Methodist church in Philadelphia, and he took the black folks with him. Now let me just share with you some of the little bits and pieces from some of the sermons that were preached by some of the revolutionaries in those days. I'm going to read something from Hyland Garnett and something from a black preacher, and from Nathaniel Paul, a black preacher. Hyland Garnett, 1848. A sermon in a black church in Buffalo, New York. If a band of Christians should attempt to enslave a race of heathen men and to entail slavery upon them and to keep them in heathenism in the midst of Christianity, the God of heaven would smile upon every effort which the injured might make to disenthrall themselves. Brethren, it is as wrong for your lordly oppressors to keep you in slavery as it was for the man-thief to steal our ancestors from the coast of Africa. You should therefore now use the same manner of resistance as would have been just in our ancestors when the bloody footprints of the first remorseless soul thief were placed upon the shores of our fatherland. The humblest peasant is as free in the sight of God as the proudest monarch that ever swayed a scepter. Liberty is a spirit sent from God, and like its great author, is no respecter of persons. Brethren, the time has come when you must act for yourselves. It is an old and true saying that if hereditary bondmen would be free, they must themselves strike the blow. That's from Garnett, 1848. Nathaniel Paul. And this passage sounds strangely like Job or Habakkuk or Amos. Listen to the beauty and the rhythm of this little passage from one of Paul's sermons. Tell me, ye mighty waters, why did ye sustain the ponderous load of misery? Or speak ye winds and say, why it was that ye executed your office to waft them onward to the still more dismal state? And ye proud waves, why did you refuse to lend your aid to have overwhelmed them with your billows? Then should they have slept sweetly in the bosom of the great deep, and so have been hid from sorrow. And O thou immaculate God, be not angry with us while we come into thy sanctuary and make the bold inquiry in this thy holy temple. Why it was that thou didst look on with calm indifference and unconcerned specter when the holy law was violated, thy divine authority despised, and a portion of thine own creatures reduced to a state of mere vassalage and misery. Nat Turner, a Baptist preacher, finally, after becoming terribly distraught with the oppression and murder of his people, stood up in church and said, the only alternative that we've got left, having tried everything else, is to kill the oppressors. And having said this, he led his congregation out, and of course history knows of the slaughter of the innocents, quote in quotes, perpetrated by one Nat Turner, a black Baptist preacher. And you can't really get the sense of what really motivated Nat Turner by reading this thing that was written by a white man and obviously racist, called The Confessions of Nat Turner. You'll have to listen to some black preacher who must agonize over the whole question, and you must understand the black condition to the extent that one wonders how one can refuse to do what Nat Turner did and at the same time remain a member of the human race. Well, these are some of the preachers of that era, revolutionary and quite violent in the defense of their people, especially when their people were being murdered. Now, the black church after slavery, most of us are familiar with, probably the one figure in this era that characterizes the black church is the president of that denomination, which has something which has almost 6 million black people in it. Reverend Jackson runs this church from his palatial palace in Chicago. He has been the president of the National Baptist Convention for years and years and years. He runs trains to wherever the convention site is of his followers, and most of you know that the Christian News and other ultra-conservative right-wing white newspapers have always used Reverend Jackson's rhetoric as the one thing that was capable of putting down Martin King and other people. So the black church sort of retired to a sort of comfortableness which defied the law of logic. It became establishment, and black people then were started to be taken in by the mainline white denominations. Well, the history of that, I think, is quite clear, pretty dormant. Black folks were tamed because they were put through all sorts of processing and, in fact, made white by the mainline establishment denomination. Some of you who have had relationships with black preachers before and after know exactly what I'm talking about, and I'm sure that most of you have. If you haven't, then I think that you might wake yourself up at this hour, because there have been some changes made. It's a sort of a reversion, if you will, to that era when the black church had to do what it did to survive. So there are 20th century visible topographies of the black church during the slavery era. These preachers have recognized the viciousness and the diabolical aspects of removing, if you will, and I think I said this in another lecture, the chains from the arms and legs of a man and putting them around his mind. And so we go through the mea culpa thing, and as one brother said to me, you know, breast beating and confessions for folks who've got it made is all right. But for folks who are trying to make it, it just won't cut it. Makes our women flat-chested and gives our men breast cancer. Sin, if you will, as it has been described, being wrong and what have you, has somehow taken a new and a different turn. And so the directions and all of the color schemes and stuff are being straightened out. The leader is a young black preacher, 30 years old, who does not have any denominational ties at this point. He has he's teaching now at Union Theological Seminary, a graduate of Garrett before that. He now was brave enough to put into print Black Power, Black Theology, and Black Power, and 40 of us now are working on what we call an introduction to theology, to black theology, where we will do the doctrine of man, the doctrine of Jesus, the doctrine of God, and even the doctrine of eschatology from the black experience. And I suppose then that the church, Western Christianity, if it is Christian, has got then an inescapable date with the destiny to become converted or go mad. The black caucuses, as so-called, and white denominations is another mark of what we are describing here. However, these are not black caucuses. Caucuses have no power. And I think that one recognizes almost immediately that when the black brethren and all of the mainline white denominations started to get together, that the church then started to become a little more than concerned about the plight of black people. It is a position of power, and it is a position which we feel might save the church and may cause, if you will, some folk to turn from their evil ways and be what Christ wants every man to be. Now I'm going to read through real quick a little section of a manuscript, Not So Random Thoughts from the Black Condition, and then I'll try and shut up and we can have some, maybe at least a few moments of discussion. The point that we want to make here now is that this is not simply discontent with where we have been, but it's an acceptance of a challenge on the part of black Christians and black people in general to move forward. While in traditional Christianity, as practiced in most white churches, the touchstone of salvation seems to be belief, faith, if you will, black people now must emphasize action. And this is not so strange, at least from a biblical point of view. It seems to me that though that white folks may have the same problem with the Epistle of James that Luther had, as we start to talk about action. But what about faith, you know? What about faith? And then we go through the rhetoric, justification, sanctification, etc., 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 etc. Words which really don't mean anything other than to put pavement on the escape routes away from the reality of action and, of course, the consequences of action. Man's duty here, the black religious experience says, man's duty here and now must be the core of future belief. We must be more concerned about our mission and less tied down to our message. Now, it seems to me that that's clear enough. Second challenge of the black religious experience, of black theology, and of black power, and these two are together, is that what we must now face has to do with the development of a new vocabulary. You know, sanctification, justification, etc. In the Middle Ages, when traditional religious thought came into contact with Greek thought, and that's we some of us, I think Dave Johnson and I might have in one discussion talked a little bit about this, and Dave may be doing a little bit of this later on this week. Dave, are you here? Will you be doing any of that later on? Yeah. Okay, good. Now, in the Middle Ages, when traditional religious thought came into contact with Greek thought, primarily that of Aristotle and secondarily that of Plato, it was greatly stimulated by Greek philosophy. As a result, a complete new vocabulary had to be created in order to deal with these new themes. Today, black religion says we need a new Christianity based on entirely new concepts and new terms. Abstract Greek concepts or Western Anglo-Saxon images have little meaning to our black youth and white youth, for that matter, and they want concepts which relate to that experience, the experience of the young, the experience of the blacks, the experiences even of the female. So therefore, as long as truth is still in the process of being revealed, black religion says we're going to put in our bits of truth, and we're going to demand that they be accepted as truth. Not that they should go unchallenged, but that they be accepted as truth after we have gone through the sufficient dialogical situations that we need to go through to convince or to convert people. The black church, we feel, also must be liberated from religious bondage. The black clergy must continue to get itself together and to decide who it is. See, the black clergy is not so much the it anymore. The who it is thing is sort of a redundancy, and it's a ploy on words. It's a put-on, if you will. Who it is. Servant of black people or an agent of white Christianity? It's a question. See, this is what some of us have, this is the milieu of some of us, you know, is that we have been more agents of white Christianity than we have been servants of black people and of people in general. And we must learn also, and we are trying to do this, not only to deal with the concept of love, but we must deal also with the concept of hate, and above all, the concept of justice. And we must find in the Christ figure the very embodiment of all of these concepts and styles. The final challenge, which this is, I say the final challenge, and I have not really elaborated all of the challenges here, but I don't want to leave you all flat like that, because the challenges are tremendous. I just want to deal with a few of them, but the final challenge as we see it has to do with the survival of the black church itself. And when we say the survival of the black church, we are talking about the survival of black people. Because we sense, more than we have ever sensed before, that the man who has proven that he is capable of programmatic genocide will not fail to do it again. We also recognize, probably more than most of you, that at this very hour, we are in a garrison state, a police state, and that the cry for law and order at the expense of justice is a cry that's going to be heard, and that there will come a time when white folks will find it necessary to cry out against law and order, and laws will be passed to silence them. The black church feels that it's not talking primarily about the survival of the black church as a denominational thing, but it feels that it has in its hands and in its heart the power of life and death as it relates itself to the promulgation of the good news in Jesus Christ. Well, we'll stop there and have discussion. All right?
What is the argument relating to the fact that Jesus was black, and what relationship does that have to black churches? And also, what relationship does that have to black churches?
You know, I should really have a test here and let somebody who now believes that Jesus is black answer the question. But
I might answer for you that Christ was part of a minority group. He was part of the suppressed people. And right now, so therefore, the Jewish people were suppressed. And he was always with the suppressed people, not the proud Pharisees and so on. But he was all with the adulterers, the drunkards. He was always with the suppressed people. And it's also today that Jesus is black, because it's just not his facial feature, but it's a state of the mind that he is with the suppressed community and not with the suppressor. The white people are the suppressor and are not affiliated with Christ at all.
Now, does that help any at all?
Well, yeah, I understand what the argument was, but I don't think very many people are familiar with that.
But what about Plagi, who, you know, is teaching that, you know, he really was black, not just this analogous kind of stuff, but was black.
Yeah, well, we don't, you know, the problem, you know, we've had some discussions in our black theological circles, you know, about the exaggerations which obviously must characterize the whole black experience. However, we find that it's pretty difficult, you know, to prove historically the blackness of Jesus other than blackness as it is the opposite of whiteness. Obviously, Jesus was not blonde-haired and blue-eyed. He took on the facial features of the folk of his time, and quite frankly, Jesus looked more like me. You know, not white, but sort of olive or bronze, if you will. And his hair was dark, and his eyes were dark, and other things about him. He had lips that were not thin, you know. He had a nose that was not terribly sharp, but he had the facial features, if you will, of the folk who lived during that time. So did Adam and Eve, for that matter. You know, how could the Lord, unless the Lord changed the color of the dirt, you know, Adam and Eve could hardly be two lily-white Anglo-European figures running through the garden, and now you see it, now you don't, sequences.
Let's get these pronouns straight.
Yeah. One black preacher said the problem is that if they depicted Adam and Eve as they really were, fig leaves wouldn't do the job. Now that has something to do with the sexual mystique, you know. And there are only one or two of us in the room who know, and we ain't talking, you know, whether this is true or not.
I thought the fig leaf proved he was white, because the fig leaf is small.
Yeah. Next week, lecture on sex and racism. I'm sorry, but some of you going to be gone. But to get back to your point, let's see, and of course to Paul's point here, Al Clegg makes a case, you know, and we accept this. This was Al Clegg's Shrine of the Black Madonna, and also Al Clegg's writing are not theological treatises. They are not as profoundly incarnational, you know, as the works which we are developing right now, ticked off, of course, by Jim Cohen's Black Power and Black Theology, who incidentally had Lutheran professors all of his life. In fact, the Lutheran seminary professor Saskatoon at the Theological Seminary in Saskatoon, Canada, is the man who encouraged him to do this incarnational piece, Jesus. The blackness as a state of the mind is a thing that we deal with. If Christ identified with the lowest, the most despicable, you know, the most reprehensible community there was at that time, shepherds and all the rest, then what color is Jesus now? And where is he? Is he or isn't he black? As it connotes a state of the mind again, and certainly he is with the oppressed people, all oppressed people.
Can I ask a personal question?
Sure.
Why do you come to this kind of a setting where you're dealing with white racists and not being the servant of the black people? Why are you being the agent of the church?
Well, see, I'm not an agent of Western Christianity. I think that's quite obvious now. I could have put on a white suit and a pith helmet, you know, and walked into the village looking the part. Missionary. Well, that's why I'm here. I'm here to reveal Jesus, reveal Christ.
What would you say are the reasons for the conditions that have taken place or are taking place for such profound racism in our society?
What would I say the reasons are for that?
Why is America racist?
Boy, I wish I knew. You know, I wish I knew. I've read most of the whole sociological bit on this. I think white folks know why they are racist. I feel that it stems from insecurity, you know. The whole majority-minority thing which plagues us right now, you know, stems from, I think, insecurity. Leroy Jones, you know, has a little poem, and you know how that poem goes. For those of you who have not heard, it's very short, I'll do it. It goes like this. Red people, 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 red people. Brown people, 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 brown people. Yellow people, oh God, yellow people, 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 yellow people. Black people, 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 and others.
Would you distinguish between individual racism and institutionalized racism?
Individual racism and institutionalized racism? One follows the other at this point, I think. Individual racists have institutionalized their racism. They've done it religiously, you know, they've done it sociologically, and certainly they've done it historically, you know, and that's what the Fuhrer is all about now, you know. Straighten out, you know, the whole institutionalized bag that we've gotten into, including the institution of the church, the institution of the university, the institution of the family, guess who's coming to dinner, you know, the whole institutional business. Institutions, and you know, anybody who knows anything about community organization, you know that institutions come as a result of somebody's having an idea, wanting that idea to catch on, and so they organize for power. And there are an awful lot of lies and stuff associated with that. Black experience, however, while we are institutionalizing, if you will, the whole revolt, the whole revolution, we're developing an ideology for it, very similar to the thing that ticked off the Bolshevik thing, have a different purpose in mind. You see, black folks not only affirm blackness, but they affirm the humanity of white folks. Little cliche for you again. Every colored man is a potential Negro who is a potential black man. Every honky is a potential white man who is a potential human being. And we operate on that premise. And we institutionalize or organize and develop ideology, if you will, to bring that theory into fact, into realization.
Well, now in response to that, do you also see the black church movement in this country as economic protest?
Well, economics are a part of it, you know. We understand the, you know, the whole capitalistic bag, you see. Economics are a part of it, as is marked by the activities of a lot of black churches and black preachers. One case in point would be William Holmes Borders in Atlanta, you know, a fantastic businessman with a huge church, you know, in the housing and in the property business. Understanding that Western Christianity, in spite of its operation primarily on and being guided specifically by the demonic, at least as it related itself to oppressed people, sort of did the same thing. We figure that we should Christianize all of the institutions, including the publishing houses, spaghetti factories, and everything that the church owns before they paganize the world. So it's very definitely, capital, money, you know, is included in this. However, that is sort of a minimal concern, you know, it's part of the whole. The main thrust, though, of the black religious experience is that of creating a climate where one gives assent to the presence of his God and of his Christ in his context, you know. And there is no choice now as to what context that is, at least as we see it.
You said the fellowship of black church is different. Can you tell me what way?
Oh, sure. You ever been in a black church? Well, I've been in a white church.
Three times.
Yeah. First of all, you know, there's an awful lot of staring at the backs of heads in white church. Of course, we're trying to get away from that now, you know. It's very, very cold, very detached, very orderly, you know. Very, very solemn, if you will. The celebration of the Eucharist, you know, sort of marks the faces of folks as if they've swallowed a live canary. But when they come from the altar, you know, the funerals are pretty much the same. The black church is a celebrating church. They whip it up, and they move. They shout, if you will. They laugh. They talk. They cry. It's a very, very human sort of thing. And every time Martin King called a mass meeting, including the last big mass meeting he had, it was church. It was church. Worship at its best. Some things you ought to check out are some things which come from directly from Africa. The Missa Luba, for example, which is an African mass. It captures you. Even if you're sitting in your room listening to it on an LP, it sort of grabs you, you know, and you become emotionally involved. I've seen some of it here at this place, and I hope that some of the young folks who are here and who have what I consider to be a worship experience will not put on a show for you, but will worship and invite those of you who are not familiar with that to join in, because it is a thing of beauty. There's dancing and there's shouting and there's clapping, you see. And the guitars are going, and the drums are going, you know, the cymbals, you know, the whole experience which comes from, if you will, the worship experience of folk in Scripture itself, embodied in the black church.
Will, can I ask you?
And of course, the quietness and the order and all of this sort of reduces the church to a non-comfort station, and we have an argument with that. A reporter in Atlanta, while we were at Dr. King's funeral, said, "Man, you folks, you know, it's a carnival atmosphere down here. You know, y'all march in and you shed a few tears as you stare at the face of your and the body of your fallen leader in that glass casket, and then you go down the aisles skipping and singing and smiling and laughing and telling jokes and doing all of the things that you shouldn't be doing. This is a very solemn moment, you see, and you shouldn't ought to do that." You see, well, that's not worship as we see it, and that is certainly not a part of the black worship experience.
This is what bothers me about Holy Family in Cabrini in Chicago. It
yeah.
seems too white, and it's in a black community.
That's right. It's a Lutheran church.
So why do we bother to bring Lutheranism to the black people?
Well, black people are going to ask you why bother, and they are asking right now, why bother to bring Lutheranism? You see, Lutheranism at this point is not to be equated with Christianity, nor is Methodism or Presbyterianism or Baptism or any of the other isms which have marked Western Christianity. Jesus, yes. Isms, no. Well, you know, a lot of folks ask, do you really think it's good? You see, but you see, every time we get into a jig, oh, when the saints go marching in, oh, when the saints go marching in, oh, Lord, I want to be in that number, when the saints go all right, groovy, right off of Bourbon Street, right out of New Orleans, right out of the black experience. And you sing it and you dance to it without knowing what you're singing and what you're dancing to.
But the people that are still alive there are feeling sorry for themselves, but you know, it's not the way. And that's the hang-up.
I find it quite easy to rejoice. When the saints go marching in.
Well, the interaction between the symbols from the Old Testament and the African prayer.
I talked a little bit about that earlier, you know, the whole Judaic, huh? Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Don't repeat it,
Yeah, I think this, you know, difference was brought out most sharply to me the last time I was in a black church. I saw several men, when they came to the preacher at the door of the church, reach around and kiss their preacher.
Well, you see, there's an awful lot of hugging and kissing and touching and feeling in the black.
Yeah, but I expected the women to do it, you know. But,
yeah.
But, you know, it's like saying, you want to go to the restroom with me? You know? It was so different.
Yeah, you know, the kiss for Western Christianity has always been a symbol of betrayal. You know? Not so with the black experience.
I wonder if you could tell us what is the viewpoint of the black leaders of the church and how the black youth are reacting to a no-compromise dealing with white people.
I think that the black church now sort of shares that, you know, the whole no-compromise posture. And the black church partially, you know, some black churchmen have done what we call the right thing for the wrong reason. You know, they have been pressured into that sort of posture in order to survive, basically because black youth have said, you know, unless you read, in addition to the standard pericopic readings, you know, the readings from the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Gospel according to Franz Fanon, and the Gospel according to Malcolm and Martin, you know, and Eldridge, and all the other 20th century prophets, and expound upon them, then we ain't coming to your church. And so the black preacher finds himself, you know, doing this, and it's terribly liberating. You know, it is the black youth. Starting when I was a black youth, you know, in Greensboro, North Carolina, and ending, you know, with Stokely's liberating sermon on that dusty highway in Mississippi, you know, this has been good for the black church.
Well, how can you relate this to the black people that are older and seem to seem to put down the movement?
Well, I say that conversion for them may come a little easier than conversion for white folks, and we are out to convert them. That's what I mean when I talk about every colored, you know, every Negro, you know, you see, the word black and the word human, you know, mean the same thing, as far as I'm concerned, and that's where the new quotes black theologians rest their case, if you will, is that you know, the gospel must be preached and the gospel must be lived, you know, to all the brothers and sisters, including those brothers and sisters in white, those black brothers and sisters in white skins, you know.
Excuse me, I just thought you know something, I'm kind of missing it, but what is Christ saying to the movement or the black movement today? What is Christ's message based on what we know of Christ?
Freedom. He's saying you're free. You are liberated.
Is it the object of, apparently it isn't, but is it the object of the Christ, of the black people, the pink on Christ lifestyle, or is it his teaching, or I can't, you know.
I think that black folks have taken on the style of Jesus. It's characterized in certain examples of black community. You know, I don't want to hear, you know, now after this, I don't want to hear any white person referring to the black community as ghetto again, because it's not ghetto. Y'all live in ghettos, we don't. We live in a community. Black folks do. And that community is characterized by one word, and Dave, you know, said, I remember one of his lectures, you know, he said, Will, I ain't going to take that away from you because it means something to me. Now, I have some questions about a soul, but I have no questions at all about soul, you see. Soul brother, soul sister, soul mother, soul father, you see. Soul.
When we speak of the church, why is there so much emphasis now on the black church? Why don't we speak of the church as Christ-like or fellowship brothers? White, black, black men, black people.
Because that's what they are.
All right, but why group yourself in such a way? Why don't we just identify ourselves as Christian?
Well, you know, we tried to do that, you know, but y'all wouldn't let us. And now we're kind of happy we didn't succeed because we would have become a part of a very, very sick community. It's an identity that we've already had. It's just that we recognize now that we had it, you know. And Jesus says to us now that there ain't nothing wrong with being black, because that's the way I made you. You know, celebrate your blackness, because it is me. It is me. And so we pick up all sorts of little things, little bits and pieces of stuff that get through to us. Luther's concept, you are little Christs, you know. Well, it so happens that we're big Christs. You know, our egos at this point are as long as Lake Chelan, maybe even longer, and just as deep. You see, and we, this is terribly consistent with the style of Jesus. He said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Self being the only instrument by which you can measure your love and acceptance of your neighbor. Western Christianity taught us to hate ourselves and to love our enemies, and the two just couldn't jive. We could not love a white man and hate ourselves, our blackness, our culture, our, quote, pagan styles, if you will, or heathen styles.
One of the other ideas where Christians come home, if they're black church or white church, or yellow church, red church.
You see, I don't believe... You see, our basic premise is that there is no such thing as a white Christian church. There is a black one, though.
There's a white racist church to which we belong.
That's just as damnably arrogant as you have been accusing the white of being.
Right.
Boy, this gives me a hang up.
Does it?
You're saying all whites are damnable, no good, and all blacks are good.
No, that's not what he's saying.
Then, sir, you must wrestle with your own guilt, which makes you feel that way, and I can't deal with that. But that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah. Why tell me about color?
Let's deal with this. Let's deal with this statement for a minute, then we'll get to that. Okay? We are saying that Jesus is with the oppressed people. Now, if a woman were here sitting in this chair, you know, she'd probably say something... say that there's something wrong with this man's world concept. And you'll say, that's just as damnable as men, as white men have been all along. How dare you do that? Which is a typical reaction from the oppressor. And that statement is designed not to liberate, but to oppress. And it's a very, very oppressive statement. The very fact that I'm here in this room with you, the very fact that I would take time to talk to you, is an indication that my ego, or arrogance, if you want to call it that, you know, is something that I offer to you. And the only thing that it's going to cost you is a divesting of your identity which is a false identity and which is tied into Clairol commercials and other things. ABM's par excellence. Or some governor that eats peanut butter and talks about young folks releasing the dogs of war. You see. See, I offer you Jesus.
In your terms.
Right. Not in my terms, in his terms. On Jesus' terms. Jesus as he has been portrayed by my white Lutheran hero, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The call of Christ to a man is a call to die. Now the question is whether or not black folks have not and are still hearing, if you will, that call. And we stand on a balcony in Memphis for you. And that's not arrogance. And don't you call it that. All right? Well, one could say that because the Colonel report said so, but then that's sort of a snide remark, isn't it? You know, we are moving towards two separate communities, one black and one white, operating under some basic presupposition that we were one community at one time, you see. Well, I asked the same question, and that's why I'm here.
What about the yellow?
We made the color barrier. We don't want to be reminded.
Where did the Panthers fit into your, the black church
thing? Do you see
a contribution there?
Yes, sir. Read Eldridge's Soul on Ice.
Well, I
read it. Well, then you know he's got some Old Testament text for some of his statements, and he also has a little thing on hate that folks always forget. You know, the price of hating is loving oneself less, you know, and the Panthers understand that. And they, you know, sociologically and politically, they are, you know, a political party, you know. The Panthers believe, and, you know, since we've got to be political in this country, white power for white people and black power for black people, red power for red people, yellow power for yellow people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know. They are authentic agents of change. And authentic human expressions from the black condition. We are. Now I know, well, violence we're going to get around to tonight. So, you know, and you know, every time somebody raises the word panther, you know, then that happens. But see, anybody who's been in the wilderness with a panther understand a little bit of what we're talking about, you know. Or anybody who's done any biological study of a panther, you know, quite docile, quite nonviolent, but looks terrible, you know, black, and he somehow evokes responses, you know, from the other animals, and they back him into a corner, and he raises up on his haunches and he bares his claws and he becomes quite indiscriminate in his violence as he seeks to protect himself. That's a panther. And the symbol of the panther, you know, did not start in Oakland, where a lot of folks think it started, but the symbol of the panther started in Lowndes County, Alabama, you know, where blacks outnumbered whites 10-1 and they couldn't even become a justice of the peace in that little community of Lowndes County. But we'll, Dave and I, we'll, I think on Thursday night, are going to do a little bit about violence and. And then, you know, we can, I think, get into some of that discussion.
If you speak of a black religion developing out of slavery conditions here in this country, with a pretty much your history, concerning yourself in the United States and West Memphis, is there a similar religion growing out of the present day of South Africa that is related or is connected in any way? Do you associate with other countries, black people, in the same manner? Do they have a different heritage?
Yeah, we associate and we identify. not in the sense that we are going to go back to Africa, you know, because we know that we would undergo the same sort of cultural shock if we tried to do that, that white folks would, you know. So there is a new culture coming, you know, growing out of this oppression. And this culture, you know, has a religious experience, you know, tied to it. That culture is distinctly African and distinctly American. And that's why we define ourselves as Afro-American, which is not, you know, a strange sort of definition, since most folks have accepted that definition. German-American, Norwegian-American, Swedish-American, Irish-American, you know, they call the Chicano people Mexican-Americans, you see. There are these. See, I have roots, believe it or not. Yeah, of course you'll believe it. I have roots in Africa, Kenya, I discovered recently, and also in Germany, Hertzfeld. Hertzfeld, Germany, that is, I discovered a long, long time ago, you know. You know, the sociological dash anthropological definition for me is colored.
Talking in the name of Christ will increase power. That's my basic question.
How can I, in the name of Christ, preach power?
Yeah.
Somebody else want to speak to that?
I just have something that I've seen in the Bible that it says, and it's a quote in the New Testament that says that God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love. And I think power is justice. But we all have power and we all need power. Except that the black people and many minorities have been
deprived
of their power too long.
Well, politically, I can understand this, because I do well see, of course, that black people have been deprived of rights. And politically, you have to fight power with power, or you get nowhere. But within a Christian context, or as the church, I can't understand the use of power.
My God, you know, that's... are you a Christian? Are you a Christian? Are you a pastor or a layman?
Yes.
You're a pastor? Don't you understand power? I mean, you know, suppose the members of your church came to you and said, Pastor, that's a social sermon. You've got too many children to be preaching that way. And suppose you allegedly capitulate. What is being exercised at that point? An evangelical, loving, spirit? Or is there some sort of conflict here between powerfulness and powerlessness? You see, the two concepts have profoundly theological overtones and undertones for me.
Well, what I see the Negro doing is changing his tactics from patience, which has gotten nowhere, admittedly, to power. And at least I understand this politically. But I don't know how a black man can justify this as a Christian.
How can you justify what you do as a Christian? Or what you have done? This is basically a Christian nation. And yet, the racism that exists is your fault.
Right.
Because the preacher or the church is supposed to be the leader.
Yeah, that's my point. I would not justify that.
Then, well, how?
So now the black man is saying, because you've done it, I'm going to do it. See, I mean, that's a different task.
No, we are not. Now, don't read us into any tit-for-tat situation. Especially those of us who are Christian and who are committed to preaching the gospel. The gospel is power. The power of God to liberate and to save. That's power.
I think the problem with our discussion here right now is that we're hung up on the word connotation of oppression. And liberation. I don't think people are really getting down to this thing on the same level. And I would propose an extra session dealing specifically with what oppression is, what liberation is, in terms of Christianity or politics, whatever you want to call it. I think until we understand the terms we're using more clearly, that this discussion isn't going to get us anywhere except
well, there's one thing that disturbs me about this isolation of Christianity from the struggle, from the power struggle.
Right.
It seems to me, justice is always, comes out of struggle, and power without justice is tyranny. And we've had an awful lot of power without justice in American society.
in the American church.
Yeah, that's what we mean by institutional racism. It's power without justice.
Could I
to say that the Christ is, unconcerned about that, that's merely a political problem. It's to me is to surrender the relevance of Christianity to the crucial issues of man and human society.
Could I follow that up on the institutional racism? I think we need to define racism also next time around. But I think we can see institutional racism, but we can't very well, as white people, see individual racism. You know, it's out there, but it's not me.
Well, the man's institutions tell us what he is. That's the only way we can, that's the only way we can figure out what he is. You know, since the only mode of expression, words have a way of betraying racism, but not quite, words are slippery, tricky things, and this is why our friend here is in a dilemma, because here we're about to get into new vocabulary versus old vocabulary. We're about to get into halo-ridden, stereotyped understanding of what words have meant, and how these words, when expressed from an entirely different culture and an entirely different condition, mean something entirely different, It sounds to one gentleman like arrogance, It sounds to some of you like, here is this poor black Christ figure sitting down here, and the one black Christ figure sitting up there, and we've got you surrounded, trying to be arrogant, trying to use power, and it's at this point that you get hung up on how you have used power to destroy utterly, to wipe out, to systematically dispossess and dehumanize. And every time we spend a nickel, as I said in one other lecture, for a Hershey bar, we capitulate and give in to that power which destroys. Taxes. Joan Baez has a thing about that, but I'm not going to give her a speech here, you see.
But what do we do here, Will, when a guy does start to open up and we all start to feel with him? We get back to our isms and our defining of terms and things again. We get very uncomfortable in this kind of interaction, and we become fearful that we might get involved here, because we are this church you're talking about.
Well, you see, this is what I say. It's sort of a bland statement, won't mean much. Don't be scared of me. I ain't gonna hurt nobody. But I believe in conflict, and I believe in crisis, you see, and I believe in struggle. I've had to believe in it. I have no other reference point other than conflict and struggle. My own personal conflict, if you will, is having gone through the change of resisting being defined and defining myself. My understanding of freedom now is not to do what I want to do, but to be what I am. That's freedom.
See, when someone starts to call you arrogant, he starts to see what you've got. And something starts to happen to a guy. Instead of listening to something up here in my head that I might understand,
Well, I'm not opposed to being called names. Don't misunderstand my emotion for blind anger. I'm not angrily blind here at this point, or blindly angry, I'm quite happy that we've got conflict, crisis.
A lot of us see you as arrogant, you see.
That's all right, sure, that's all right.
In a way, like, you're trying to smooth over this whole thing, because
right.
I think that middle-class Americans do not know how to bring a conflict, and that they try and resolve it, and in the process, ignore a lot of the issues involved.
They resolve it in their heads, but they don't resolve it in their persons.
Well, you can't read it in for everyone else.
Pardon?
You don't know what everyone else is thinking. You're speaking for everyone inside all our minds, and you can't do that.
That's part of the problem, is that most people don't speak for them.
That's true. You cannot. You have to use your own mind and then think and seek the situation out and then speak it the way you feel it. We're all individuals. He's an individual. He's an individual. I'm an individual. You can't speak for
me. Let me define what I meant, Willie, when I said this to me sounds awfully arrogant. What I was hearing was that all the others. I already kind of copped out of it and kind of is either black or white. This to me is an awfully meaningless kind of concept. And I I might not have been hearing it in the words in which you were saying or something. But when you say now that twice might be Christian, this is what I heard, I might hear the way you said it, that black is the real way to be. It seems to me that this is doing the same thing to the white as I agree the white has been doing to the black. Now, I'm not too sure that if one sin has been committed, that another sin of the same kind but in the opposite direction therefore ought to be committed. And that's
I accept your understanding of what I said, you know, which is not it's not strange to me, you know, except that I still don't think that you're hearing the gospel.
Billy, why don't you sort of make the statement you made Monday for so many people that haven't been here in terms of that a black man cannot become a white man, but a white man can become black.
You just said it. Blackness as it connotes a state of the mind. You see, I accept unequivocally the fact that I have got black brothers and white skins. Not skin color, but a state of the mind. And Jesus, when he says you're either for me or against me, you know, says that. You see, you are either white or black. You know, and here white folks, you know, have sort of defined themselves in terms of who they are not. I am not black. I am not young. I don't have long hair. You know, I'm not a woman. You know, I mean, and you know, and the whole white male syndrome in this country is a thing that's killing us. And that's what I propose. You know, I'm opening a door for you to get out of that. But it's going to cost you the identity which you have held on to, which is a false identity. Quite false and hypocritical.
I think you can use the word instead of you're saying white people become black. I think the point is that the black church now is the closest thing we have to a real human potential movement in our country today. And by human potential, I mean specifically that sex roles in our society, consumerism in our society, are the things that too many of us, too many middle-class Americans, escape into to avoid the real issue, who am I, my own self-identity. And the black church is responding to that. It sees through this. And that's why when Paul will say, well, I feel uncomfortable when I see black men coming up and kissing a black creature. That real human feeling, real human potential is devoid of any sex role that limits us to a certain response, a certain reaction to a person. And I think that when Willie talks about white people becoming black, he is talking specifically about the human potential in the society that is being so flagrantly abused.
And like when Willie brought up the fact that women are oppressed, people just laughed about it. I really think that people don't have an understanding of it.
Well, talk up so that people can hear you there, because that's important.
When Willie brought up the part about this being a man's world, and that perhaps if a woman were sitting in his chair and we're talking about women as the group that is oppressed.
She'd be laughed out of the room.
Well, it's not even so much that, but just the people here laugh at the prospects of women being discussed. And I think that in relation to what Pete said about sexuality and roles, the people really have to understand that in order to understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, let me see if I can explain this, you know, in some sort of asphaltized terminology. Those of you know that my thing about asphaltizing means that things are not entirely concrete, you know. So, and that's the way it ought to be, you know, as we get into the struggle. The Hefnerian philosophy, says, you know, not only says, but it does. You know, it takes a creature created and redeemed by God, abundantly endowed, obviously, you know, puts a skin-tight thing on it and a little bit of white stuff on her bottom and some ears around her head, and she is no longer a woman but a bunny, you see. Now that bothers me. It bothers me because I understand oppression. Elmer Witt says, watch the Miss America pageant. You know, it'll tell you something about oppression. There she is, Miss America, my ideal. Whose ideal? You know, whose ideal is she? Is she not a roboticized thing created for the sorensification and the ego of a thing that defies the law of logic for me? You see. Now, so when a woman says, my brains are not between my legs, but they are in my head where God put them, then this becomes terribly insulting, lewd and salacious and dirty and quite threatening to people. Not to me, because, again, I understand oppression.
And what happens to all the other attributes of woman?
Yes. Yes. Gentleman here one night said, Jesus had calluses on his hands, even if he did have long hair. Young man with long hair fell backward from the railing there. I understand oppression. And we have to run all of these things down, and I should not be doing this, because here I am presuming to speak for women and for white kids who might elect to have long hair for whatever reason. And for red people who are naturally psychedelic and who don't have to use artificial means to get there, you know. I cannot presume to speak for those people, but I say that they enjoy a condition which I enjoy. And that condition is not a white condition, but a black one. Oppression. Now let me just presuppose another question, you see, which comes as a result of what you said. What happens when black people take over in this country, and red people and brown people, you know, the allies, you know, what happens, and young people, you know, and women, you know, what happens when they take over, you see? What happens when they become the oppressor? Well, God forbid. But as a man committed to Jesus, if that should happen, then I am always with the oppressed. I am always with the oppressed because I am with Jesus. I must be with Jesus. He is not just my Savior, He is my brother. That's what the incarnation is all about. So, you know, I don't want to argue, you know, what happens when black people start oppressing white people. You know, that is not apropos to the discussion. Right now we're talking about oppressor and oppressed and how you deal with that Christocentrically.
Isn't one problem of the oppressed is that they are not allies? And that indeed we see divisiveness here among the minority groups, the white or the black and the yellow and the red.
Well, you see, that divisiveness, you know, comes as a result of something else. You see, the Biafrans and the Nigerians are fighting each other in order to survive. We all know that. In order to survive. And they're trying to they're killing each other in order to get out from under the Super Shell and the Standard Oil and the Union 76 signs that you can find on the corners of those towns.
The hatred of the evil and the Western and the Roman tribes did not exist prior to the coming of the 76 signs.
One of the big conflicts came with the Igbos sort of capitulating to Western stuff. I am smarter than you because I talk with a British accent. You know. And one hardly talks about Nigeria and Biafra. One must talk about Nigeria-Biafra. One and the same engaged in a struggle for survival. Well, we don't want to talk about that now. I don't want to take us geographically to the other side of both oceans. We've got a problem right here at Holden. You know.
Isn't it wonderful when people such as these two right here can not empathize and agree with you and understand your way of thinking and at least in any other terms of that. And then this gentleman over here comes up with sort of an attacking statement, which I would take to be an attacking statement with me involved. And automatically some people turn against him or some people turn for him. But isn't your whole mission the idea of, wouldn't it be a great joy to you to, say, convert someone? Isn't it, I mean, to not only your way of thinking, but the way you feel it should be. And this man, obviously, in your feeling, has the gospel all wrong.
Well,
you advise him to take another look at the gospel.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be wonderful for you to talk to this man personally, instead of just shrugging him off and saying that you don't know the gospel?
Well, the man who asked the question, I think, will admit that this is not the first time we have been in the same situation. Won't you do that for them?
Sure.
We'll define the situation. It's called Matrix, isn't it? Huh? All right. And it's a few hundred miles removed from this place in the city, in a YMCA, San Francisco, California. He is not turned off. I would say that the wonderfulness, you know, comes not in there, in these young people agreeing with me. You know, I was introduced to them, and somebody said that they would agree with me. That wonderfulness does not come as a result of my going, you know, like I have collected a couple of white spiritual scalps here. You know. The wonderfulness is not that at all. The wonderfulness is not in total agreement. I think that we will, you know, we undoubtedly have some things that we will disagree on, you know. The wonderfulness and the sweetness, if you will, comes from one's understanding finally what the gospel is. And joining the church, if you will, you know.
But not knowing your conflict, I could just see that you were shorting him off.
No, I am not shrugging him off because he will always be there.
Really, I think one of the main things that all of us can do is maybe reflect on our own congregations at home and see if some of these things can't prick deeply into our own lives and into the situations we're involved in. I know that at Grace Lutheran in Santa Barbara we have a terrible problem as far as white racists. And I see a very Scandinavian church who, I'm sure Pastor Paul knows many problems and has many difficulties there because they're very much in themselves, and one of our problems is to get them out into the community. We had an open housing proposition on our ballot in November, and only two of us from our church worked for this. And United Church Women, the Catholic Welfare, Human Relations Council, all of the churches practically were backing this, and only two people from our church were involved. And most of them want to come to church and have this comforting service and not be aroused by the other problems.
Yeah, you know, the traditional statement after a conference has ended and there's been minimal conflict is the question, where do we go from here? Well, we get on a bus and we go to the boat and we go up Lake Chelan and we get on a bus and we go home singing merrily along the way, you know. That's where we go from here. Now, the guru would somehow sneak in a little transcendentalism here and he would provide some other place to go, you know. We go everywhere but where we are, you know. And that's the thing that brings tears to my eyes is that the brothers on the street, when I get back, will say, "Where you been, Will?" And I'll say, "Been up to Holden Village, baby." "Where's that?" "Well, you go up to Chelan, Washington, and then you get on a boat and you go for 3 hours." And, you know, he said, "Is that right, baby?" "Yeah, that's where..." boy, you know, that's something. You know, what you do up? Well, I talked with some white folks. No kidding. You mean you got out of there after talking to them? Undoubtedly, you went up there shucking and jiving. You know, where were they from? From Los Angeles and Riverside and Anaheim. Hey, baby, somebody go and get some binoculars and let's see if we can see some smoke over yonder. If we don't see any smoke over yonder, then we know that Hertzfeld has been up there lying again. You know, those are the kind of results that one expects, you know, and that's where you go from here, you see. The call of Jesus is a call to die. But then, you know, the 450th anniversary of the Reformation of the Lutheran churches, with emphasis on the churches at this point, you know, I koinonia, you know, here we are, fellowship, you know, and all we need is some wine and some bread, and we could, you know, really celebrate the servant presence of Christ around the fire here, and I believe that with every fiber of my being, you know, so here we are. What are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about it? You don't resolve the conflict here. You know, you don't. You just can't. It's out there where the rubber hits the road that the conflict is resolved. Or at least folks are snatched out of a terrible, terrible condition. And it seems to me that that's what the Christian church ought to be all about. Well, now it's lunchtime for those who will be going to the first setting. It is not lunchtime for those who will be going... Wait a minute. It is time for Dave Johnson's thing at 11. We have got, Dave, we got 15 more minutes, I think. So can we, or have we got 15 more minutes?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, Dave Johnson comes on in 15 minutes, so let's see if we can ask some more questions right away now. And okay.
You said that black people cannot become white, white people can become black. And then I wonder if the white people should ever want to try to become black in spirit, not in paint, if there would not still be a stigma as far as the black man is concerned, these people are really not a superficial. Roman Catholic Bishop in Spokane came out with a very controversial article just a couple of weeks ago, which he said black is beautiful.
Some folks, some folks cannot hear the brother talking, y'all, so please, I'm having difficulty hearing him too. Please, may I hear him? Go ahead.
The Roman Catholic Bishop of Spokane came out with an article just a couple of weeks ago in the paper in which he stated, black is beautiful. If I could do it over again, I would wish to be a black man. And of course, this is misinterpreted. We don't know exactly what he was trying to say from our own culture, but again, I wonder, can a white person ever become black and erase the so-called stigma that we have to see you, no matter how hard we try?
Yes, 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 you can. It's not difficult. It's sort of strange that folks who ask me questions like this are folks that I've had experiences with. You know, I'm not ashamed to, you know, to say I had an experience with you, you know. Yesterday, for I don't know how long was it, 3 hours? It must have been, but we stood and we didn't tire, apparently, you know, as you described, you know, the non-community called the community. The agony of being a brother to the superintendent's kid. By the way, this gentleman spent his young and tender years in this village when it was... Well, when it was what it is now, I guess, I don't know. Well, that's neither here nor there. But he was a kid here, and the superintendent lived over there, you know, right there. Was he called a superintendent? And you lived down here, way down the path here. And the superintendent's son and you were competitors with newspaper roots in this town, right? He had the best paper, but you worked harder. Now, that's it's par for the course, you know. Poor people do work hard. They're not lazy and shiftless and no account, you know, as a lot of folks say. And they understand leisure too, I think. But you see, oppression in this town is something that I can understand. And I say that if you have been oppressed, you are ready. You are ready because you understand oppression. So, yes, you can. if you want to. Now, you see, but when you do, you know, you can prepare yourself for social ostracism or whatever that, and that's death for white people, being ostracized socially. That's death for them.
Am I going to condemn? I'm going to know until they give me an opportunity to see if, in fact, I have been oppressed. And there's a different amount of degree of oppression that I might have felt as a son of a working person is not the oppression that you feel as a son of a working person who is also an inferior political class, so forth, social class, stomped on from other places. So I never had to ride the back of a bus. So I've not been oppressed as much as you have.
But you see, the very fact that you can draw the differences at this point mean that you understand oppression. I'm not trying to free you here, you know, because you could go back to Spokane and get killed for quoting me, you know. And I want you to understand that too. But I hope you do. Not get killed, but quote me.
You're talking about the oppression and oppressor. Where will
Well, you see, I think that what Jesus was trying to get at was the elimination of the oppressor. See, he came in to do battle with the oppressor, you know, whoever he or she was, you know. George Wallace's Nightmare, for example, you know, my God, she's white. No, that's not what he said now, y'all. My God, she's black. You know, God was not only a woman, but she was black. See? Now, you know, I know what that does to George Wallace. He runs to Billie Jean Hargis and he gets absolution. Billie Jean. Billie Jean, by the way, is the guy who's doing what you were suggesting in South Africa in the name of Jesus, you know, he is probably the best symbol of the white oppressor there is, you know. Then he's followed closely by Billy Graham and a few others, you know, the guy who has the devotions at the White House, occasionally, more often than not, you see. And this whole thing, you know, is sort of where you are, even though confessionally you don't agree with them. You see, so confessionally.
Isn't the oppressor that's really the captive?
But no, I got to get back to her thing. You know, it would be very interesting, I believe, you know, to have women do something other than, and some of you women, I know, want to do this, you know, and you're free to do this, to have your sessions on women's liberation. You know, now, see, most men, when they think about women's liberation, you know, they, again, operate under certain stereotypes which come from the Telegraph Avenue scene, that women's liberation means sans bra and girdle and other apparatus, you know, which have made women. But that's not what women's liberation means to me, at least as it has been articulated by women. In fact, real women liberators, you know, get mad with me when I come on with those jokes now. That's how sensitive they are. And I understand that too, because I too am sensitive to black jokes in toilets and stuff like this, you see. And I understand that, you know. It's a very serious movement. Jesus doing battle with the demonic. He went into the wilderness and he was promised all of that stuff, you know. And so in the name of Jesus, you know, we have trapped folks that way. And so Jesus is doing that sort of battle to eliminate the oppressor, which means that then that there will be no more oppressed, because there won't be any oppressors. Now, somebody will ask, when will that take place? And right now, I can only say when the kingdom comes. But in the meantime, I'm going to do battle with the oppressor.
Nobody mentioned power together. When we speak about oppressor, in the Bible, it was the oppressor.
The devil? You mean what color is the devil?
No. Oh. That's the oppressor, the original oppressor.
Who is the original oppressor?
No.
The devil.
Where does the devil fit in?
Well, I'm sorry, I can't make myself clear. I, the
the Bible and the Old Testament uses the term oppressor in reference to the devil. And you can take any
That's right. I don't know how much more I can say about that than, you know, than what I've said already. You know, the devil does have many faces, you know, sexes, shapes, you know, sizes, you know, things. You know, the red man says, you know, there's a Mescalero chief on the Stewart Reservation up in Stewart, Nevada. You know, how he got there, well, everybody knows. You know, but anyway, he says, well, you know, you guys are really superstitious. You know, snakes talking and things. You know, and so I'm trying to get away from that as much as I can. You know, and try and talk not so much about the devil as I talk about the demonic. I guess, you know, which sort of. It's a slippery way of, you know, of not dealing with something that I must deal with, but yet I realize I can't. Now, it's sort of strange to hear a Lutheran preacher say I can't deal with something, but I can't. You know, I can't fit the devil into all those slots and stuff. You know, the devil, I just can't do that. So I really don't understand the question. You know, and even if I understood it, I'm not sure I could answer it.
No.
Yeah, Luther. Some folks said that he was high on that beer that Kitty brewed for him, but he was always throwing his inkwell at it. You know, ink spots all over his wall where he was throwing his inkwell at the devil. He never got any ink on himself, though. He did put some ink on them vicious tracts that he wrote against Jewish people and against the Pope. Racist, very racist. Baden says that he should have died earlier. Huh?
Each man has his own oppressor.
Each man has his what? His oppressor?
Only oppressor is in himself.
Well, I would suppose that if one buys the old Adam thing that Luther does, and I think I understand that, you know, the whole, how does the Latin phrase go? Simul justus et peccator, you know, saint and sinner at the same time. You know, it's the sinner part of us that oppresses the saintly part of us, you know. But I say that, you know, the saintly can operate because it's a powerful thing and beautiful, and it ought to be in operation, you know. And so the black preacher says, we're ready to baptize those of you who are converted. We will do it by immersion. We will do it by immersion. Now, some of y'all will only remember in the name of, but then that means you were not converted, you see, before your lungs fill with water and stuff. I mean, you know, the old Adam has really got to be washed away, and we must use the symbolism, the symbol of baptism. Sprinkling, you know, won't do it. Martin Marty says that when he was getting ready to baptize somebody, and the concern was not necessarily the washing away of the old Adam, but how much water was going to get on this baptismal gown that had been passed, you know, along for 35 generations. And on purpose, Marty says, he just wet it up. Because, you know, even the baptismal gown had become, you know, a sort of oppressive symbol.
This is what I was saying before. Basically, the oppressor is the one that's counted.
Why black power? Joe's basic thesis, you know, is that the oppressor is the one who's in prison. Yes, who's captive. Martin King used to always say that, you know.
You know.
Could I ask a question of clarification? Did you say that it is possible, or the black church is the church, because it is oppressed? I mean, it is only possible to be the church when you are a part of the oppressed people.
Check that out. If you are the church, then the world ain't going to cotton to you. And it's going to oppress you.
Now, does this mean that the function of the church, of the black church in our day, being a hope for the rest of the church, is a temporary role if the oppression of the black people should cease?
All I can say is that, you know, is that we are working like beavers to bring in the kingdom. And it's at that point, now, you know, I'm not waiting for the eschaton, You know, I don't have my nose in my mailbox, you know, waiting for the eschaton. Some people say, I am. It may come in a brown manila envelope, which could be my paycheck, or it could be, you know, a telegram from the Lord that says, come on home, you know, time's out, you know, for oppression and being oppressed, you know, come on home. But you see, we have people to deal with, you know, the gospel must liberate, you know. The gospel must be the good news for bad condition, you know. It must be that. That's what the gospel is. Jesus must be that. Jesus does not get off of the streets of our cities, you know. He is there with the people, you know. He is proclaiming liberation from the oppressor to them. And the oppressor, you know, says, no, you can't do that, you see. Now, some churches think that they can carry God piggyback into the world, you know. For example, they can pick him up and move him whenever they want to. When the children of the night move in, the children of the light move out, the angels. And therefore, you've got those fashionable things that some folks call churches taking up space where grass is green and where birds are singing. Jesus is there. He is, as McLeod says, confined to stained glass windows and altars, stained glass windows and organs playing and the general ecclesiastical masturbatorial exercise that people go through, you know, when they go into church. And meanwhile, you know, the oppressed are standing outside of the place, you know, just scratching their head and wondering if they're serious, you see, taking up that space. So that there is some rather serious question at this point, you know, as to whether we can move Jesus like that, you see. McLeod then says, I wish to resurrect one truth about Jesus, is that he was not crucified on an altar between two golden candlesticks, but on a cross between two thieves, on the town's garbage heap, where people were indulging in sexual promiscuity, they were talking dirty language, they were ranting and raving, you know, totally oblivious to the God-man suspended between earth and heaven, but yet the blood flows from his veins and washes all that is beneath them. Now, traditional Western white Christianity says it washed them white and made them white as the new fallen snow. Well, you know, the little black kid looked in his mirror and he said, what happened to me? What's with all of this whiteness, you know, white as snow business, y'all? The coming of the kingdom, you know, sounds the death knell for oppression. Baden says some folks are going to be terribly surprised, you know, is that there are going to be a lot of Eucharistic garments, albs and chasubles and chancel prances and all of that in hell, while those folks who didn't do that are going to be enjoying the beauties of heaven.
But if the time should come and history should go on, and the black people are no longer oppressed, then they cannot be the true church anymore, is that right?
If black people are not oppressed, they can't be the... Well, what we are talking about is eliminating the oppressor, and the kingdom will be here. Black people, I will always be the church. The black condition will always express what the church is.
Because they're already being oppressed?
No. Because they were the ones. See, Jesus didn't lose his thing, his identity. You know? He didn't lose it. And he is on the throne now, and he still has that identity. And I feel that Jesus is at work. Otherwise, there's no reason for the incarnation with the oppressed people. And when he delivers, he maintains his identity.
About this, I think getting kind of hung up on the figuration of oppressed and oppressor.
Well, yeah, the question leads me away from the now, you know, and that's what I want to deal with, yeah.
Just because, you know, people are once oppressed, once they're not oppressed anymore, doesn't necessarily mean that you'll automatically become oppressed. Because they've reached that.
The only time that black Christians will cease to be Christian is when they become the oppressors. But you see, I don't want to deal with that because that's not what, you know, that's not what I'm here to deal with. It is now time for David Johnson.